Extra time.
He shoots, and it's a goal!
Welcome back to Sunday Vibes Extra Time, the podcast. Doogie Woo-hoo. Critchley is in the hot seat alongside Christopher Hamill. Today we're going to be looking at the good, the bad and the ugly from Winter Windows Just Gone and very far back, I believe. One of yours is Hamill, is it?
Leeds? It is, mate. It's Ooh. Very 90s.
Ooh, we'll also be kicking Euro Zeds out of football and Chris will be playing Facts with Rafa Benitez. Let's go.
I'm kicking us off then, and mine's going to be a two-parter because it's pretty darn long. I've been quite ambitious this week, gentlemen.
Oh, God.
I've tried to pick out three transfers from Leeds' history, modern history at the very least, to really represent them as a club.
So you've gone club-specific?
I have gone club-specific. Leeds are flavour of the month, aren't they? Thanks to Bielsa's football, thanks to Spygate, thanks to bushes and pliers everywhere.
Shout out the bushes.
So my section is called The Perpetual Rise and Fall of Leeds United.
Oh, what a title.
Look, he's got his own title to the table.
But this week, Perpetual. We're going to rotate it a little bit more, aren't we? Because you guys have gone a little bit more sporadic with your suggestions. Yeah. They're not all interlinked, whereas mine are. So I'll tee it up and then bring it on home after your sections, okay?
Love it.
So I was just fascinated by Leeds. I am in general, just because of their tendency to be a yo-yo club. They've almost defined the term yo-yo club in football. In fact, doing a Leeds has a 613-word definition on Wikipedia, which in short basically details how financial mismanagement can quickly undo years of good work, no matter your standing in the football community.
Okay.
So I've picked out three winter signings because, of course, the transfer window changed that made it January specific some years ago in the sort of the early noughties. So I've gone winter signings that sort of November onwards that really encapsulate this. So number one, Rio Ferdinand, bought in the late 2000s, November to be specific. He was supposed to help usher in a new era, which Leeds became a regular in Europe's elite competition, the UCL.
Ooh.
Of course, famously reaching the semi-final. And this was the last time they demonstrated any real transfer clout. They paid £18 million for him from West Ham.
Big
Harry Redknapp said he's going to go on to be one of the best in the world. And he was right, was old wobbly chin Harry. It was a British record.
Put some respect on Harry Redknapp's name. King of the jungle.
I've got nothing but respect for that man. One of my first interviews at Football Daily, Harry Redknapp.
Actually, lovely guy,
went
wasn't
he? BT Tower.
That's a big
he was.
Name to get first.
He was fantastic.
Such a nice guy.
That was a British record, £18 million, gentlemen, and it made him the world's most expensive defender to boot, which prompted Franco Baresi to say the AC Milan legend, the man who got over a knee injury in about 3.5 minutes, a serious one, that he could possibly be better than me.
Ooh,
Franco. Indeed.
And I'm not sure, you know, Franco's summary of that. I have to check back in with him after this. But a towering performance against Deportivo La Coruña in the quarterfinals of the Champions League, which Leeds won 3-2 on aggregate, was probably the pinnacle of his Leeds career.
Still, that's a good pinnacle.
Yeah, but he wasn't there for very long. And I think had he been at any of the top club in that period, you know, like he went on to play for Manchester United, they probably would have built the side around him and some of the key personnel, but he quickly became a chess piece, a very expensive chess piece in Leeds' game of financial mismanagement. So they eventually sold him on to Manchester United for £30 million.
Class business by us.
So, I mean, they made a healthy profit at the time. Leeds saved a lot of face with the transfer fee. But ultimately, the club was so desperate by the time his final payment came round, they accepted an early fee, a knockdown fee of £1.5 million when United owed them £3.5 million. So that's how desperate they were by the time they let him go, or you know, the
Superb.
Subsequent couple of years, despite him costing £30 million, despite them putting that in their coffers, you know, they were willing to forego a couple mil because the Wolves were at the door. Now, number two is Robbie Fowler. So again, bought in late November, this time 2001. He really embodies Leeds trying to arrest the inevitable slump and save the dream from becoming a sort of meaningless financial black hole. Ultimately, his best days were behind him, and so were the clubs. So it was somewhat of an omen. Basically, he scored 183 times in 369 appearances for Liverpool, where they referred to him as God, famously. But he was sidelined under Houllier following the sort of prolific nature of the Heskey-Owen partnership. And, I mean, he really did not get on with Houllier. He still accuses Houllier of forcing him out of the club to this day, saying that he used the Liverpool Echo to turn the people of Liverpool against the Toxteth boy.
Oh, naughty.
Cost Leeds £11 million, which at the time, pretty darn expensive.
Yeah.
And he scored 12 goals in his first season, so arriving in November, not too bad at all. But injuries quickly took their toll, and this is, you know, I couldn't begrudge Leeds fans for feeling a little bit cursed, you know, when it comes to just football in general in the modern history. He only bagged 14 in 34 in total, equating to $750,000 a goal for the club before he was shipped to Manchester City, where they paid a third of his wages.
Jesus.
And then they publicly asked him to defer the wages and said the only way he's getting his money, again, when they were financially crippled 2-3 years later, was if he sued them. So, acrimonious break.
Right.
And number three, I could have picked any underwhelming free transfer here, but I thought it was nice to go from someone of Fowler's stature and prolific scoring nature to someone like Tor-André Flo, who they picked up from Vålerenga in 2006 in January. So this one definitely qualifies for our theme. And it was because basically Dennis Wise was heading up the club at that time, brought in an old teammate to kind of do him a favour. Didn't really work out. I think he only scored 4 in 24 appearances and was apparently sponsored by club fans, the Kaiser Chiefs. Yes, you heard me correctly. I'm not sure in what capacity, but that sentence exists in the digital landscape.
He was specifically sponsored by it.
Yes, and I would love to know specifics on that. Leeds fans,
a little album for a signing. Or...
I don't know.
Amazing.
What did Kaiser Chiefs sing?
I don't know, but I think...
Tori. Was that Kaiser Chiefs?
I don't know. No. Yeah, George is nodding. It could well have been Kaiser Chiefs.
Nodding.
He loves Kaiser Chiefs. Yeah.
Bang up.
Look at him. He's just putting his finger up now. Number one fan.
Love the love the indie scene in the early 2000s. Scouting for Girls, actually, George's favourite band ever. So basically, yes, those three kind of surmise the journey I'm about to take you on. Now, this was a club that spent £52 million in 2003 at the height of their recklessness. And then, subsequently, shit hit the fan very, very quickly. Spent just £5.9 million over the next 7 windows. 3 of those windows equating to the square root of fuck all. They spent £0 in 3 windows. So, when I come back in, I'm going to do a quick history. I'm going to do early 2000s. We're going to touch upon owners, various shysters, and where they are now. So back over to one of you guys. Who wants to come in?
I'll come in. I don't mind coming in. So me and Doogie have taken a slightly different approach to Chris. Chris has obviously found one club that is synonymous with dodgy dealings in January. Me and Doogie have come at a slightly different angle, I think it's fair to say, Doogs. We've kind of got a good transfer, a weird transfer, and a bad transfer.
That's
kind of the rough theme we've gone for. I'm going to kick us off then with a little known man, Thiago Manuel Díaz Correa.
You guys have no idea how many times he's practiced that.
Yes. Also known to the industry as Bebe.
Ooh, Bebe.
To Manchester United. Yes, of course. This is an epic story. I thought I'd start right back at Bebe's birth. Because it's one hell of an interesting backstory, so bear with me a little bit.
I thought you were going to say interesting birth. I was going to say.
So up until the age of 12, he lived with his parents, but at 12, they sadly decided they couldn't look after him anymore and decided they were going to abandon him. And they sent him off to a Catholic orphanage. Said, look, we can't look after you. His grandmother accompanied him there, said, look, you're going to be here for 2 weeks. He ended up staying for 8 years. Between the age of 18 and 20. So obviously a very sad early few years. But that is where he fell in love with football. He didn't actually start playing football properly until he was 16.
Really?
So he had a very rapid rise to the top because he didn't join his first team till he was 16. That was a Sunday league side called Lures. Obviously, he quickly became their best player. He stayed there for a further 3 years until he was 19. At 19, now a lot of people have probably heard this story about him supposedly playing in the Homeless World Cup. He never actually played in the Homeless World Cup. He did, however, get selected by the CAIS, which is the Homeless Association of Portugal, to play in the European Street Football Festival known as FOCA 09.
Myth-busting.
So he didn't play in the Homeless World Cup. He was asked to represent Portugal at the Homeless World Cup, but at that stage, he was already playing professional football, so opted not to represent them. At that tournament, he performed rather well. 40 goals in 6 games, he put in.
40?
Yeah, 40. At an average of 6.7 goals per 90, so not too bad.
Just a casual 6.9.
You know, just a casual number there. That is basically where he really blew up. So that tournament happened in Bosnia. There were a few people that were keeping fairly close tabs on him, even then, because he was doing quite well for his Sunday league team. But he said he only went to the tournament as a joke. Luckily, he did go to it. So he comes back from the tournament and he decides he's got a few offers on the table and he decides to join Estrella de Amadora. They're in the third tier. They offered him 300 euros a week. So that's not too bad if you're Bebe and you're living in an orphanage still at this stage.
That's a good next step.
They also gave him a 1.5 million euro buyout clause. So for a third tier side, that's quite a lofty buyout clause. Bebe, though, wasn't sure whether to accept because he didn't want to leave the orphanage. So he decided, rather than leaving the orphanage, he was going to commute the 2.5 hours every day to Estrella to train and play games. And then he could come back and he could live in the orphanage with his friends. He's obviously, I think, probably because of the way he was brought up, he was a little bit nervous about the outside world.
Understandably.
Didn't necessarily trust it. So he also didn't have a particularly good education, understandably as well. So he obviously got this offer. He chose to join them. He started well. In his first 26 games, he scored 4, but he made another 14 in the third tier. So he quickly became sort of their star player. He quickly became Estrella's best player. And that is where he met Gonzalo Reis, who was a budding agent who immediately signed Bebe upon seeing him. I read a few articles and interviews with Reis, and he claims that he was a father figure to Bebe and bought him loads of boots. How much of that is true doesn't really give much detail to whether it is. But nevertheless, Estrella couldn't pay his wages. So despite offering him wages of that £300 a week or €300 per week, they couldn't pay it and they couldn't honour his contract. So he walked out of the club and becoming a free agent, this is where he got his big jump. He joined Vitória de Guimarães. I want to pronounce it something like that. So a Liga Nosh side. They'd finished 10th the previous season and he started with a bang. So he's jumped straight from the Sunday League to the third tier to Liga Nosh within a year.
Fair play.
He scored 5 in 6 in his first 6 games and Marca ran a headline, the Spanish paper ran a headline, linking him really heavily to Real Madrid. Real Madrid scouts had been to watch a few Vitória games. They were very interested. A number of British media outlets said that Manchester United was set to rival Madrid. They wanted to sign him as well. Obviously, he ended up at Madrid. But there is a few little twists and turns in the narrative before we get to that because this is where Jorge Mendes sticks his greasy fingers into the situation, taking Bebe under his wing and taking 40% of the player's image rights, removing his previous agent, Rice, in the process without notification. Rice later lodged an appeal with FIFA. It gets pretty sketchy as to the detail of what happened after that. But
it's a bit of a coup.
A bit of a coup. Jorge signs him 3 days before he joins Manchester United.
Right.
So very clear what happens here. Manchester United paid his 9 million euro release clause from Vitória, bought him in to join the likes of Anderson and Nani, who had also been signed from the Portuguese league. And Jorge took a fair chunk. 40% of that went to Jorge Mendes. So he clearly knew what he was doing. He'd arranged this. He had very strong ties to Manchester United, to Carlos Queiroz, to Sir Alex Ferguson. Sir Alex Ferguson actually admitted that this is the only player he has ever watched that this is the only player he's ever signed that he had never watched.
I remember him saying that.
Which is really interesting. He said he had a report from Carlos Queiroz that this lad was extremely talented. He spoke to Jorge Mendes. Jorge Mendes was hyping him up. Jorge Mendes also had really good ties to Vitória because he had previously, of course, brokered the deal taking Nuno Espirito Santo, the now Wolves manager, from Vitória to Deportivo in 97. Yeah. So that was one of his first major deals in Portugal, and it kind of got the ball rolling, and Vitória held Jorge Mendes in quite high esteem. So part of the reason that he was able to broker this deal so quickly was that Nuno Espirito Santo transfer. He joined Manchester United earning £17,000 a week, so a big step up, and receiving a £500,000 signing bonus, which is pretty much unheard of back then anyway, for a player relatively unknown. And when they paid a buyout clause. That was obviously another Jorge Mendes move. But it's just a nice Cinderella story, I think. Going from €300 a week at a third division team in Portugal to £17,000 a week at Manchester United. Going from an orphanage to the theatre of dreams, Manchester United. Look, it didn't work out. Obviously, there were the famous chants of if Bebe's on the pitch, so are we. All those sort of things. He only got, I believe, 334 minutes for Manchester United. That's just 7 appearances. Did score twice. So he has scored for Manchester United, but never started a game, unfortunately. United then loaned him a further 3 times to Beşiktaş, Rio Ave and Pacos.
He's doing okay at Rayo Vallecano now, right?
He is. I'll quickly touch on his future post-Manchester United. At Pacos, by the way, when United let him leave on loan, he actually banged 14 goals in 36 games. That was enough for Benfica to come in for him, signing from Manchester United for €3 million. Only played one game there. Then he found a little bit of life in Spain, like you touched on there, mainly at Rayo Vallecano, played 2,000 minutes, actually created 10 goals, I believe in 16-17, I think it was, putting up one key pass per 90, over a dribble per 90. Ibar then went and picked him up, didn't really work out, so he's now joined Vallecano, played just 380 minutes this season, still got a goal though. Scored wherever he's been, fair enough to him. You know, I just thought this is a good story, a bit of a weird one, because this is a player who is almost folklore now in English football, I'd say. He's almost who was the player Southampton signed that was like a trialist?
Souness signed him.
Ali Deia.
You know, it's got a bit of a hint of Ali Deia about it, because he was previously an orphanage. You know, there's all the tales about homeless, sadly enough there. Well, not sadly enough, they're not quite true. He did play at a tournament, but not the Homeless World Cup. And it's just a good feel-good story, I think, despite the fact it's an extremely weird transfer and Manchester United were fully hoodwinked by Jorge Mendes. So that's my weird. Doogie, do you want to pitch in with a weird?
Yeah, I can go straight in with my weird. And it's one that's happened this week. And I thought it'd be good to touch on it, because everyone is pretty baffled by Kevin Prince-Boateng's move to Barcelona.
Awful.
Not least in the FD office.
What do you mean? Put some respect on the prince's name.
We've been pretty confused. So basically, he's joined Barcelona from Sassuolo on loan until the end of the year. And they have an option to sign him permanently for £7.1 million in the summer. Now, he's had a pretty nomadic career. He's actually 31. He'll be 32 in March, so he's definitely not in his prime. And this is his 9th professional club. He's played for the likes of Hertha Berlin. He's played for Spurs. He's played for Portsmouth. He's played for Milan, Schalke, Las Palmas, Eintracht Frankfurt. He's also got 15 caps for Ghana. So he's pretty well travelled. His best year was without doubt at AC Milan in 2010-11, which was actually their last league title.
Was that when he scored the goal?
Yeah, he played a crucial... Yeah, exactly, in the Champions League. Played a pretty crucial role in that year. He played 26 league games, so only missed about 10 or so. 3 goals, 2 assists. Not that, big output, but he played a lot of games. He was useful. He then played 15 matches over the next 2 years as they finished second and third. So he's been in a sort of elite environment beforehand.
But he's incredibly injury-prone, isn't he?
Big time, yeah. He's had a lot of injuries. But his form this year actually hasn't been too bad, despite that. So he's got 4 goals and 1 assist in 13 Serie A games this year. And he's been in a seriously strong environment before. That 2010-11 Milan side was really pretty good. He was playing off Zlatan for most of the time. They got created a really good partnership. He's then subsequently gone on to Eintracht Frankfurt, won a Pokal. So he's got a bit of experience at the top level. But his best year since has probably been 16-17 in La Liga. And he went to Las Palmas. He scored 10 and assisted 4. for the Gran Canarians. So he was directly involved in 26% of their league goals, which helped them finish 14th. And this is Las Palmas, who aren't actually a very big club. That was actually their third best finish this century.
And he is, but was he playing as a striker at Palmas?
No, I think he was playing in midfield.
So this is the first time this season.
He's basically been moved further up.
Yeah. This season he's a nine, isn't he?
This season he's a nine, definitely. So he's basically been brought in to add attacking depth. I mean, Paco obviously left last summer. Meunier's gone recently to Sevilla. So they were looking for a sort of someone to bring on if Suarez needs a rest or if he needs to come off in the last 30 minutes of games. And StatsBomb released a really interesting article. So I'm not taking any credit for these stats I'm about to come up with about how he could be used. So he's taking 2.8 shots per 90 this year, which is pretty average. It's certainly not outstanding. And his XG per shot is 0.07, which effectively means he's taking quite a lot of shots, but not from very good areas. So that's not great.
You know, and by virtue of being an attacking midfielder a lot of his career, or a midfielder, does he tend to take a lot of his shots from outside the box?
Yeah, big time. Right. They're not in good areas whatsoever. But also, Sassuolo aren't the most coherent attacking unit, which I'll come on to in just a minute. But you might be thinking, as an ex-midfielder, maybe he can drop deep, you know, link up a play, bring a bit of creativity. His actually expected assists per 90 this year is actually 0.09, which isn't very good at all. So he's not a great goal scorer. He's not a great creator.
That's half the combined expected assists and goals of Joan Jordan, the
is
one
it?
And only.
There we go. There we go. Hamill's favourite. But as I said before, Sassuolo aren't the most coherent attacking unit. They actually average 533 passes per game, which is really high. I think that's sixth in Serie A. So they dominate a lot of the ball, but their tactics are effectively to dominate lots of the ball. We won't give the opponent any of the ball. They obviously can't score, but they're not particularly attacking with their possession, basically. But that's kind of necessary because they're pretty weak defensively. So their tactic is, we'll keep hold of it and then we can't concede. They give up 13.3 shots per game, which is the ninth most in Serie A. Not too bad. But the XG they allow per game is 1.4 per game, which is actually the fourth worst in Serie A. So Sassuolo don't have a good defence. They basically need someone to put in a lot of effort up front, closing people down, harrying people down, and then be able to keep hold of possession, which is what Kevin Prince-Boateng can do. He's a reasonably good at retaining possession. He's just not that devastating with it. Mm-hmm. So it sounds kind of like a shit Barcelona, if that makes sense. They're a patient attacking play. They don't have a cutting edge to it, but they do dominate the ball.
A lot of the fans wanted the manager at Barcelona, didn't they?
Sorry.
Earlier this season, a lot of the Barcelona fans.
Big time.
This transfer just is awful.
I don't think it makes particular sense because
it's awful.
Because there are better players who are under 30 at, you know, who can come on if Suarez needs a break, if you've got a lead to protect for the last 30 minutes of game and hurry and hustle people who have a better sell-on value than Kevin Prince-Boateng. I know it's a loan, so it's relatively low risk, but I just think there's still, another week of this transfer window. Could they not have got someone better?
Like, I mean, they've let Meunier go in this transfer window. Are we really saying that Boateng's going to do a better job than Meunier? Like, Alvaro Morata's gone on loan to Atleti.
Yeah.
Did they have a serious effort at that? Yeah. On loan, again? I mean, I just don't get it. If Suarez needs a break, Messi plays at nine. If Messi's playing at nine, then they play Malcolm on the right or they play Coutinho on the left and move Usman to the right. I don't get what the point of bringing Boateng in is. If I was a Barcelona fan and we'd signed Boateng, I would be thinking, fucking hell, it's awful. Like, surely Barcelona fans at home, I can't speak for you, would rather see an academy graduate given minutes than Kevin Prince-Boateng at 31, who has had consistent injuries throughout his career, be forced into a number nine role behind Suarez.
He also doesn't have the best attitude as well. He's fallen out with quite a few clubs. He actually left Eintracht Frankfurt because they couldn't basically agree personal terms on a new contract. So he's got a bit of a mixed pass. But Barcelona's transfer thinking in terms of strikers this window, definitely, as far as rumours are concerned, has been quite muddled anyway. They were linked with Fernando Llorente. They were linked with Olivier Giroud. So they weren't really linked with top striking talents. And maybe they just thought Kevin Prince-Boateng, you know, he's obviously keen to go to Barcelona. It's relatively low risk. There's nothing that much to lose. They just could have done a lot better with a lot of Champions League games coming up as well. So I think it's risky.
That's the issue for me, though.
It's got a lot of sauce.
But that's the issue for me is Barcelona are going to win La Liga, aren't they? Like, we all know Barcelona are going to win La Liga at this stage. They need to, if they're going to be making signings need to have impact in the Champions League for them. because that is where that should be their secondary goal. If the primary goal is, in fact, to win La Liga, Champions League might be their primary goal and they're just bumbling along because the rest of La Liga is crap at the moment. But Kevin Prince-Boateng is not going to impact their Champions League push. Now, I've said this, he'll probably score in the final, but I just can't. In the league, and you're 5-6 points clear, surely you'd rather 17-year-olds get in minutes
but
there.
I'm ambivalent on it. I mean, selling Meunier for 1.5 and bringing this guy in for potentially 7.5 is fundamentally the thing that doesn't make sense for me. But it's okay. It's low risk. He'll be on the peripheries of the squad. He, you know, worst comes to worst, he might have, you know, the Paulinho effect where he can play as an auxiliary number 9 or an attacking midfielder. It's bizarre, but
they're basically backing his ability to be able to lead the line against lowly La Liga sides. When everything this season suggests he won't be able to do that.
It's so anti-Barcelona.
They've made some quite strange moves
recently under Valverde.
Over 30 players have become more and more common.
But I don't know, man. Maybe if Barcelona fans are thinking differently to me, but I feel like if I was a Barcelona fan, this is very anti-Barcelona, who have definitely got a clear policy of promoting youth and making the best of La Masia. I can't remember the last decent La Masia graduate that came through.
Elena's coming through now, isn't he?
Elena is
being given minutes. He actually made his La Liga debut as well recently, and he had a very positive impact. He's kind of seen as the, not necessarily heir to Iniesta's throne at La Masia, but he's a very kind of diminutive, tricky mobile midfielder. So let's see how he pans out. But is it back to you in this game of tennis, Joe?
Are we going back to me now?
Yeah.
Okay, let's come back to me. Sure. And we'll head to you after we've done our goods and our bads. So my good is John Stones to Everton. Yeah, I know a lot of people will be saying, hey, don't Man City in summer. Well, I'm talking about Barnsley to Everton. Because Everton signed him on the 1st of February 2013, aged just 18, for £3 million, which is absolutely nothing when you think about it. Because it's not like this was 2003. £3 million would have been a lot. 2013, to pick up a talent like John Stones, £3 million is great, given that the only other club that was seriously interested was Wigan. Wigan and Everton both agreed £3 million fees with Barnsley, and the player opted to join Everton. The man to sign him was David Moyes.
He knows a good defender when he sees one, doesn't he?
He does, to be fair. No, we joke about David Moyes, but he had some very good defences at Everton.
Sylvian Distin.
He was obviously only with David.
Joseph Yobba.
He was obviously only with Moyes for 6 months, because Moyes left for Manchester United that same summer. In came Roberto Martinez. In the window, actually, that John Stones was signed by Everton, Everton tried to sign Leroy Fer from FC Twente. He failed his medical, so not a great start. They tried to sign Alvaro Negredo from Sevilla, but couldn't pay his £15 million clause. They tried to sign Jack Butland from Birmingham, but he rejected him and ended up at Stoke. So they didn't have the best window, but
I like they tried to sign Negredo but didn't have enough money.
I know.
that's a poor attempt, isn't it? Trying to sign
didn't
someone.
Want a matches. Ah. I think they didn't
actually,
want a match.
Can't afford him.
Didn't want a match.
As it turned out,
did someone
City,
else come in and grumpy
for them?
City ended up getting him, didn't they?
It was all right.
But either way, it ended up being a pretty good window because John Stones joined. At the time, John Stones was playing as a sort of dynamic right back and centre back at Barnsley. So he wasn't the centre-back we all know and love now. He was flying up and down the wing. He'd been capped 2 times by the England under-19 squad. There was very clearly a push for him to be moved into the centre. That was something Barnsley saw, I think, from when he was 16, 17, that he's probably going to end up as a centre-back. But in order to get him first-team minutes, they were using him as a right-back on occasion as well. He actually credits John Stones, Barnsley, with his current ability on the ball. So when he was growing up, his academy director at Barnsley and his academy coach, Ronnie Branson and Mark Burton, were both obsessed with Barcelona's style of play. Now, people will be laughing at home because Barnsley and Barcelona, nothing to connect them other than the B. Now, what Barnsley did in the youth academy under Branson and Burton is that they emulated Barcelona's 4-3-3. They used split centre-backs and they enforced two rules. They enforced the rule of no passes over head height, and they enforce the rule of a minimum amount of passes before you score a goal. This is where John Stones effectively credits his ability to play on the deck, because he would have to split, he'd have to keep the ball. You couldn't just hoof it long to a big target man. And that is not something I would associate with a club like Barnsley in League One or the Championship. You know, these clubs that are building strong academies like Barnsley, you just don't think about these kind of things. But clearly these sort of things are happening behind the scenes. He was also working under Gareth Southgate because Gareth Southgate was the England under 20 boss at the time, or under 21, whatever that level is at the time. Southgate loved Stones. Now, Southgate, we do pan him a little bit for his lack of tactical vision, but equally, I think he's definitely one of the more modern English managers out there in terms of he wants to play with the ball on the ground quickly.
I think he has a clear tactical vision for England. It's just that maybe he's not as like tactically versatile as other top-level managers.
Yeah, that's probably a fairer way of putting him. Obviously, Southgate loved him, said, look, we can't rush him. We've got to keep this lad in the setup. And at Everton, Roberto Martinez absolutely loved him. Roberto Martinez, obviously, let's not forget, rejected 3 bids for him in 2015 from Chelsea in January, up to 30 mil, which was a lot of money. I actually remember seeing back pages back then in 2015 and thinking, how are they rejecting 30 mil for John Stones? Well, Martinez came out. I read a press conference today. He said Stones could be the best centre-back this country has ever produced.
Wow.
Which is a big quote from Roberto Martinez, isn't it? Bobby Moore in there, you know, Rio Ferdinand in there. So some pretty good ones. But I drilled down into some of his numbers at Everton and Manchester City, and it's easy to see why all of his previous managers, including Pep Guardiola now, rate him as maybe their best centre-back. Obviously, Laporte has stepped onto the scene now, really, at City, and is probably their number one, I would say. Mm. But before Laporte, I think Stones could be argued as City's best.
And him and Laporte are very, very similar as well. It's not like a company Otamendi dynamic, is it? Or a company Di Michaelis. There's not one headless
chicken.
Born one day apart, those two are as well. Which is a bit of a weird one.
There we go, match made in heaven.
But yeah, when he first joined Everton in that 13-14 season, obviously only played half a year, but 1,300 minutes, even back then, 90% pass accuracy. But he was averaging just 37 passes a game, clearly flying out the line quite a lot as well, because he was producing 3 tackles and interceptions. This theme kind of continues through 14-15 and 15-16, around 90% pass accuracy both seasons, about 50 passes, and in fact, in 15-16, nearly 4 tackles and interceptions a game from centre half. So clearly Roberto Martinez was asking him to step out the line and both pass and sort of defend from the front. Whereas when he went to City under Pep, it obviously changes. His pass accuracy climbs, 93% pass accuracy 16-17, and in fact last season his pass accuracy in the Premier League was 96%, which is outrageous for a centre back. And in both occasions his passes about 60-70. I think in 17-18 he was actually averaging 78 passes per game, which is mad how much he's progressed from that Everton team that he was averaging 37, nearly double, in fact over double. But his tackles and interceptions have fallen right off, so Pep is clearly not asking him to step out the line in the same way Roberto Martinez, about 2, so nearly half. In fact, in 17-18 his tackles and interceptions were exactly half of his final season of Everton, so Pep is asking him to sit back and distribute.
Yeah. If you adjusted that for possession, it'd still be really, really high.
Yeah, it probably will be. Yeah, you're probably right. If you adjusted it for possession, it would be pretty high. Although the Bobby Martinez teams were still averaging 60% possession Everton. And imagine City probably a little bit more, 70%, maybe upwards of 60%. But equally, you can see that at City, he's not maybe getting as much game time as he'd hoped. In 17-18, only 1,300 minutes in the Premier League. Mm.
He had that period after January, right, where he fell out of favour with Pep Guardiola.
A little bit.
After some high-profile mistakes.
Bit. But equally, clearly a fabulous, fabulous centre-back. Barnsley recouped £7 million from sell-on percentages when he went to Manchester City for, was it, £50 million? Something like that.
Great deal for them as well.
Great deal for Barnsley. One of the best bits of English business to be done in the January window in recent years, I would say, in John Stones. And he's gone on to be an absolute weapon of a player.
He has. 100%. He certainly has.
Great January signing.
Do you want to come with your best and then I'll lay down maybe Leeds' an overview of their history and touch upon the 2000s before we go back to you guys for your final segments?
Sure, yeah. You want to hold on for my worst, but my best is actually a pretty feel-good story as well. It's Marcelo to Real Madrid. In terms of
this
European,
is the greatest January signing of all time.
In terms of European transfers, it can't really be topped. So Marcelo began his career at Rio-based side Fluminense. He won the annual state championship, the Campeonato Carioca, in 2005 and played 18 league games in 2006. And he was only, I think he was only about 18, 19. Fluminense finished in mid-table. Marcelo was excellent. He was named in the team of the year at only 18. Sorry, I've got it down here now. I see it. And he made his debut for Brazil that year at 18. He scored in a 2-0 win over Wales at White Hart Lane. No idea why that game was going on, but anyway, and what a weird location for it. But anyway, he then joined Real Madrid in January 2007, and he was brought in by Roman Calderon, who was the much sort of maligned president that took over after Florentino Perez, that oversaw not such a successful era of them. It's important to note that at the time, Los Blancos actually hadn't won a league title in 3 years and hadn't reached since 2002-03 and hadn't reached a UCL semi-final since that same year. So it was a bit of a downturn for Real Madrid at that particular moment.
This is when Valencia in the ascendancy, Valencia and sort of Deportivo had won a few titles.
Yeah, exactly. And Barcelona had won the Champions League the year before. Yeah. I mean, they had a pretty useful team with Ronaldinho and Deco and Eto and people like that. And he was, when he arrived, he was competing with Roberto Carlos. People forget that they actually overlapped for a brief time. So 2 months after he joined, Roberto Carlos made an awful mistake in the UCL round of 16 against Bayern Munich. He basically failed to control a back pass, got tackled, and Roy Mackay scored.
Oh, I loved Roy Mackay.
True story, he's held me as a child.
One of my all-time favourite strikers.
Should have saved that for facts.
I should have, damn.
You should have as well, that would have been a great fact. One of my all-time favourite strikers, Roy Mackay. What? Legend.
We've got to quickly go, why was he holding you as a child?
My dad took his football team over there, or the all-conquering Woodgate 80s, shout out to the boys, who are about 40 now. So not boys. And they beat Kevin Keegan's Newcastle under-18s in the final, but in the semi-final they played against I think the team that Roy Mackay was representing at the time, so it must have been a Dutch side.
I can't remember.
I think it's before he went to Leverkusen, then obviously that preceded Munich, but yeah, my dad was sort of a big fan of his from early doors, and there's like a... I'll see if I can dig out a photo of him the next time.
He's a mad man, pretty obscure.
He's just such a legend.
I remember him looking a little bit like Luis Suarez.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't have the best complexion, is how I remember it.
A little bit feral.
I mean, yeah.
All right. Well, there we go.
Sorry, Dig. Back to you, mate.
No worries. Well, he scored in this game, sort of embarrassed Roberto Carlos. So Roberto Carlos was sort of embarrassed by Bayern as a whole. And he sort of lost his place from then on. He then went and joined Fenerbahce at the end of that year. Marcelo only made 6 appearances in his first year, but Real Madrid won the title on head-to-head. From the following year on, though, Marcelo's been a regular. Since then, he's racked up 471 appearances for the club, which is actually 17th on the all-time list. And if he plays another 20 games this year, I think that can jump to about 13th. So he's right up there. The only year he wasn't a regular was 08-09 under Juan de Ramos, when he favoured the more defensively minded Gabriel Heinze at left back.
I'll speak about Juan de Ramos later.
Yeah. Not the best spell in charge of Real Madrid. But he did actually do one good thing for Marcelo. He basically experimented with playing Marcelo as a winger, which was continued by Manuel Pellegrini during his season in charge in 09-10. And Marcelo was fantastic as a winger. He played 35 games at left wing, mainly left wing that year. He scored 4 goals and assisted 9, which was only topped by Messi, Dani Alves and Xavi in that year's assist charts.
Xavi.
A lot of assists for that year from Xavi. And Barcelona won the league by 3 points. He said that at the end of that year, I actually see myself as a better winger than a left back.
Pep Guardiola said that was the hardest Real Madrid side he's ever faced.
Really? Really? Pellegrini, I'm not surprised. Yeah. It was a great team. Mourinho then came in and was like, Marcelo, no, you're going back to left back. And he's been there ever since, really. Since 2009-10, he's assisted 50 league goals and scored 21 in 274 La Liga games. So that's 0.25 goal contributions per game, which is pretty mental from a left back. So effectively, one every 3 or so games, he gets a goal contribution. Over that period, he's averaged 1.7 key passes, 1.8 dribbles and 1.1 shots per 90 from left back in 9 years. That's the consistency.
He's one of the greats.
100%.
Arguably their best ever left back, Brazil. Arguments to be made.
Yeah.
Maybe not at international level.
People would still argue
about that.
That's
club level, yeah. Is he the most decorated?
Is Maxwell Brazilian?
I think it might be Dani Alves.
Either Dani Alves or Maxwell.
Yeah, definitely.
Where's Maxwell from?
Obscene amount of trophies.
Brazil.
Yeah.
And his form hasn't really dropped off. This year, he's still averaging 1.3 shots, 2.2 key passes, and 1.8 dribbles. So those stats are effectively, I think it was the second best in his whole time at Real Madrid. So he's not getting any worse. But I've watched a few highlights of Real Madrid this year when I can, and he seems to be getting caught out of position quite regularly. He's made a few more sort of routine mistakes. And there's talk that he wouldn't actually be the worst loss come the summer. He's sort of, it's slightly catching up with him. I think he maybe needs to be.
Juventus have been circulating for a long time.
Yeah, they still go on.
I see that happening.
Calcio Mercato was still reporting today that Real Madrid are considering him, considering selling him in this summer, and they will still get a lot of money for him. And they're looking at Junior Firpo, Real Betis's left back.
I reckon Man City might have a nibble at Marcelo if they get the chance.
That'd be great.
You know, when they tried to pick up Dani Alves, didn't they, and that to solve that right back issue, they've not really got a backup left back behind Benjamin Mendy.
True.
If you have Marcelo,
as I covered the other day in the podcast,
it's not a terrible move for Man City if he
does. But it'd be a massive loss for Real Madrid at the same time. I mean, the amount of experience that he brings, his success, he's won 4 La Ligas, 2 Copa del Reyes, 4 Champions Leagues. He's been named in the UEFA Team of the Year 3 times. He's an absolute club legend. The best January transfer window signing, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think ever. I actually do think he's the best January transfer window signing ever. Better than Vidic and Suarez.
Fair play. But from Marcelo to Marcelo Bielsa's boys.
Yes,
seamless.
Lovely.
Right, I'm going to do a quick history and then the early noughties of Leeds, explaining why the sort of transfer window embodies how they have failed and succeeded as a club intermittently. So let's touch upon their history very briefly, build you a picture, add some colour. So Leeds United formed in 1919 after Leeds City were expelled from the Football League for making illegal player payments. So that's a bad omen from the start, isn't it?
That pretty much sums Leeds United up as a club, doesn't it? That's how you got going, and that's the reputation that's followed them around for years to come.
The original iteration was barred. Yes, and they had a relatively mediocre early history, which is pretty forgiving for the sake of this podcast, because it means I get to skip over a large period of time. One Division Two title until Don Revy, a former professional, played for Leicester, I believe, and apprentice bricklayer from Middlesbrough, took charge in 1961, turning them into a true footballing force. And he did this by promoting youth. He cultivated a really strong family atmosphere, according to this excellent article I read in Esquire. That was somewhat an underrated part of his management, apparently. No drinking problems in a time when that was rife. A lot of the team at the club had families and just led very kind of, not bog standard existences. That makes it sound a little dour. But yeah, professional, quiet lives. And they also achieved a certain amount of notoriety by deploying a brutally physical brand of winning. In fact, one of their star centre-halves, Norman Hunter, had the nicknames Bite Your Legs. That was his nickname.
How is that a nickname?
Because of the way he snapped into tackles, and he made 540 appearances from them, pretty much.
Lucky you weren't alive back then, too, because you've been bite your fingernails.
Bite your fingernails, class.
Enough of that, Tomlinson.
So he was at the club from 62 to 76. But a lot of people do say that the Dirty Leeds was overplayed, and they were sort of an anti-establishment club and subsequently hated by clubs from the south. And obviously that big rivalry with Chelsea came from that. They were league winners in 1969 and 1974, FA Cup winners in 72, and European Cup finalists in 75, where they were beaten 2-0 by Bayern. But sort of any Leeds fan worth their salt will contest that they were absolutely robbed in that final. So I think it was Lorimer denied a volley, and apparently the refereeing was very, very suspect. But I did not have time to go into that. So we move on. But Don Revy, I mean, after he left, and he left for the England job, the club sort of fizzled back off. This was a club who's heavily reliant on the sort of the genius, one man galvanising them. The North Stand, subsequently known, well, that has now been named after him, and there is a statue of him outside. This is the sort of impression he left on the club. And only Bielsa has a greater win percentage at the moment than Revy. But, you know, Revy managed 740 games, so Bielsa got a long way to go before he matches that. But we'll get back onto Bielsa later, because that is the sort of potentially the phoenix rising from the ashes yet again. But after Revy, they go through 7 managers in 11 years, slipping into the second division. And the highlight of that period, it took me a little while to find one, was a 3-2 loss to Coventry in the FA Cup semi-final. So Leeds fans, not a lot to cheer for going through the 80s. So just bear that in mind as we progress towards the giddy heights of the 2000s. So Howard Wilkinson comes in the 90s, deploys a boring, conservative, winning brand of football. So he gets them promoted into the second division, and then they eventually win the 1992 top flight, the last division one title before the Premier League era is ushered in, with a side that includes Eric Cantona, Gordon Strachan and David Batty. So there's some talent in
Eric Cantona. Wow, that was a good bit of business, selling him to United, wasn't it?
I mean, that could also
don't be like that, Joe.
That could also go in the set. I know, smug.
Yeah. I know, I think, but
you actually managed to transmit that smugness as well.
But equally, Manchester United taking Leeds' greatest ever player, which is fantastic.
Well, I mean, it's a recurrent theme, isn't it? So, I mean, that we could kind of deviate from the course and touch upon how that was a terrible bit of business in itself, but we won't. And in typical sort of Leeds fashion, they went from winning the title to narrowly avoiding relegation in 1993, failed to win a single away game all season. Jesus. So the only time a defending champion has achieved that feat. So this is what I mean by the definition of yo-yo club. But in the 2000s, you can almost forgive Leeds for thinking, that's behind us now.
The Viduka era.
The Mark Viduka, brought him from Celtic.
Yes. Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank era.
£6 million. Yeah.
Alan Smith.
What a team they had then. Cool. Lee Bowyer in the midfield, kicking the lumps out of people.
When they bought Viduka from Celtic, we actually had a forward triumvirate of Viduka, Paolo Di Canio and Georges Cadet. It was brilliant.
That is not too bad.
Moving on, 2000s, where the purse strings are loosened. David Batty's already returned to the club. He came back in 1998. A £4.4 million move was sanctioned for him, and big money signings were made after the club came fifth in 1999. So here, like I said, the money's been made available, and they've sniffed European football, gentlemen. They've come fifth, and all of a sudden, Ridsdale thinks, I'm onto something here. I could join European royalty.
He's had a bump of it.
He signed Dewberry, who was a formidable centre-half. Bridges, Wilcox, Darren Huckabee, who, you know, later was an absolute boss at Norwich. And Danny Mills selling Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank to Atletico Madrid, who I think went on to score almost 30 goals in that season and still got relegated with Atletico Madrid. So he came back with Chelsea. But yeah, the club announces a £29 million turnover that year, £6 million of which is profit, which is mental for Leeds' standards. So what do? Instead of, you know, putting this away for a rainy day, instead of building in a responsible manner and thinking, you know what, the next 3 or 4 years won't define us, no. They proceed to bring in Viduka, Dacourt, or Olivier Dacourt, and Rio. And these... Rio was in the winter window, which I've touched upon earlier. Well, around winter, November. And this is where it starts to get bloody messy, gentlemen. So Peter Ridsdale, chairman through this period, infamously said of this period, to surmise it, that Leeds lived the dream. They lived the dream. And now it is a nightmare that won't end. And Bielsa is probably their only way out at current. David O'Leary, okay, so in 2000 reaches the UEFA Cup semi-final, where obviously two fans tragically lost their lives after they clashed with fans in Galatasaray. So there was sort of, I suppose, that galvanised the Leeds community, and in a way, I've already said it, it galvanised the community, and they used that negative energy to fuel a decent end-of-season performance. 2001 UCL semi-final. So Ridsdale, he sanctioned some spending. They're reaching semi-finals. He's a fucking genius, as does David O'Leary, who wrote a book about Leeds at this point, which was...
about his time at Leeds?
Not well-timed, yeah, let's say.
I used to like David O'Leary's Leeds, though. They had Viduka up top. Remember that Jimmy kit? Milner in the midfield.
Remember the yellow Strongbow kit with the stripes across it? That was
massively
gorgeous.
Massively oversized.
Woodgate and Rio at the back as well. They had a good side.
Yeah, who did they have in goal as well? Nigel Martin?
Don't know. No, Nigel Martin was Everton, wasn't he?
I can't remember.
Anyway.
Flowers. Maybe. George's Malvern, is he?
Tim Flowers.
I think it was Tim Flowers, maybe.
It might have been.
We're not quite sure.
I thought it was Nigel Martin. But yeah, there was loads of people coming through in that period. And after they reach the 2001 semi-final, they pretty much doubled down on recruitment. But they finished fourth in the league, which at that point was only good enough for UEFA Cup spot. So the English coefficient wasn't as good back then.
It was Nigel Martin, by the way. 207 appearances.
Fair play.
Joseph.
Must have just... Did he end up at Everton?
Yeah, he did. He went to Everton from Leeds.
Oh, Nige. So in 2002, the club are top of the Premier League on New Year's Day. Like I've said, David O'Leary is on cloud nine at this point, but it all goes tits up from there. Leeds fall back into their yo-yoing ways, losing to Cardiff in the FA Cup, knocked out of the UEFA Cup by PSV, finish fifth. So they've sanctioned a load of spend, and they've finished one place lower, and they're no closer to European football, which of course is very important to this point, especially with their spending habits, because it's very lucrative. And more so than, obviously at this point, the Premier League heavily outweighs that, but at that point, it really was the promised land. So O'Leary is replaced by Terry Venables, and Venables famously said, finally, a team I can win the league with. But oh, no. Shit hit the fan again.
Terry.
Like a sack of potatoes. So in 2003, Leeds reported the largest loss for an English club at 49.5 million. The year before was 34 million. So they end up having to have a quick fire sale. Robbie Keane, went to Spurs for £7 million. Absolute cut price. Rio is moved on for 30. Like I said, very good deal. And it sort of, it helps them out in the short term. Lee Bowyer, who almost joined Liverpool for £10 million months before, leaves West Ham for 100k as his contract declines, as it comes to an end.
Arsenal vibes, that.
Yeah, Dakor goes on loan. Dakor on loan to Roma. And Fowler goes to City, where Leeds paid some of his wages, which we touched upon earlier. Ridsdale then came out in the press and announced that Jonathan Woodgate, their last great hope, you know, the 50%, you know, half the partnership, that was going to be a future England duo, that would not be sold, only for him to be eating his words almost imminently as he was flogged to Newcastle for £9 million, which kind of, you know, brings about the question, how did they not get more for him when they negotiated 30 for Rio at that point? Because Woodgate had, you know, his stock was as high. Harry Kewell left for £5 million, £2 million of which went to his agent. And Venable left, and top flight status was only saved by a 3-2 victory over Arsenal under...
Good old Arsenal, keeping him up.
Under a caretaker manager, I want to... Oh, what's his name? I've forgotten his name. I'll remember in a bit. But yeah, in October that year, Peter Reid, that's it. In October that year, the club then declared they were in £78 million worth of debt. So the lavish spending started to surface here as people were questioning, what the fuck are Leeds spending their money on?
Yeah, because they've made millions here. They're about 50 million up at the moment.
I mean, you'd have thought some of those big sales would have offset their more lavish spending on players. But no, it's still clocking up behind the scenes. So half the staff had private cars. The board were frequently noted to have taken a lot of private jets. And I think you probably heard this anecdote by now, but the chairman was in fact renting goldfish at £20 a month. Renting goldfish. That was how financially savvy they were. Didn't just go out and buy them. Didn't win one for a pound at the fair.
You can buy them for like literally for 60p. I've bought goldfish before for 50, 60p.
I think maybe tropical fish. I can imagine the big tanks bubbling as Ridsdale,
just to impress his new signings or... Look at my fish. A mug.
To add an ambiance to his office, because, you know, things were rosy back
class.
Then, weren't they?
Mike feeling the fish.
Feeling the fish. He's back. Get that on a T-shirt. So a consortium of Yorkshire businessmen then had to step in and keep the club out of administration by, you know, doing a little boring stuff, restructuring debt. But in May 2004, they were beaten by Bolton 4-1, securing their relegation to the second tier. And when they went down in 2004, they had debts of over £100 million.
That's
now
obscene, isn't it?
I'm going to leave this now until the end, but the Ken Bates reign is coming in. The guy who sold Chelsea to Roman Abramovich, the guy who's got more offshore accounts than Harry Redknapp's dog. Okay,
allegedly.
You can't see that I'm doing inverted commas. Joe, over to you for your final transfer.
Okay, my final transfer, we have to talk about him. It's the man, the mystery, Julian Faubert.
Ah, the infamous.
Of course, who joined Real Madrid on loan from West Ham United. He joined West Ham United from Bordeaux for £6.1 million in 2007 on a 5-year contract. immediately ruptured his Achilles. Don't mean to laugh, but pretty funny. It was out for 6 months, but that didn't put Wande Ramos off, did it? Oh no, Wande needed a right winger come right back, because I believe Sergio Ramos was playing right back at that stage. Correct me if I'm wrong, I might well be, but I think they had Cannavaro and Pepe playing
centre. That sounds about right.
Anyway, so he's looking for a right winger come right back. You know, he was originally desperate to sign Antonio Valencia. Man United obviously ended up picking him up, but Real Madrid wouldn't pay the €35 million that Wigan wanted. So, you know, it's already worrying, isn't it? If Real Madrid are shopping at Wigan, you already know it's pretty worrying. But Wande, he was desperate. He approached Jermaine Pennant. Jermaine Pennant?
What Jeremy earth? Kyle?
Is Wande smoking at this point?
Well, Wande at this point is being advised by Camoli.
Camoli?
Yes.
Who was his previously previous sporting director at Spurs?
Yeah, Liverpool. Previous. So he was the sporting director with Wande Ramos at Tottenham. So Wande obviously left Tottenham, went to Madrid, and was still getting advice. And I've looked at it, and it appears like Camoli was just stitching him up just because he knew that he didn't want to have to play Faubert in the league. That's what it feels like, because why they moved for €1.5 million they paid for this loan fee for 6 months. It was a disaster, Real Madrid. Real Madrid as a whole
were
a disaster.
Also, why would Wigan be willing to let him go just for $1.5 million?
How much West Ham.
Sorry.
That's how much he left West Ham for Madrid.
Yeah, so West Ham are willing to let him go for 6 months, and they value 6 months of his absence at £1.5 million.
Unbelievable. And it was
paid more than that for Jermaine Ali there.
I know. It's a disastrous season for Madrid, I think it's fair to say. Finished on just 78 points in La Liga. Jesus. Lost 10 games in the league. This is the same season, of course, they got pumped 6-2 by Barcelona at the Bernabeu. Two just fantastic anecdotes I want to bring up about Julian. Obviously, he only appeared twice, but he was pictured asleep on the bench.
He said he wasn't asleep.
He said he was just resting his eyes, which is the age old excuse for any napper, isn't it? Oh, you go, don't nap, don't fall asleep. Oh, I'm just resting my eyes. You know, when your girlfriend says you shouldn't be sleeping now, I'm just resting my eyes. Shut up.
As he watching that rom com for the 5,000th time.
I know. So he proclaims he was just resting his eyes on the bench against Villarreal, and of course the infamous incident at training where he didn't show up for 2 days. Basically thought it was the weekend, but it wasn't the weekend. He got his days mixed up.
What was this guy on?
Absolute disaster.
I reckon he was
there's no way that's true.
Yeah, that's genuinely true. He missed 2 days of training because he thought he'd been given the time off for the weekend.
I think Faubert was having quite a few parties in Madrid by the sounds of things.
Probably, mate. Obviously, they didn't choose to take up the
It's like the real hustle. If I was him, I'd be having parties as well. I'd just complete one of the greatest coups.
Unsurprisingly, they didn't take up the option to buy it. €6.5 million at West Ham set. But he has since gone on to have a glittering career at Kilmarnock's under-20s. He was there He was there 2016. Kilmarnock under-20s as a player, mate. As a player.
On trial.
Wow. On trial. On
Stevie
trial
Clark
in the under-20s side.
I think and St Mirren ended up signing, didn't they?
I didn't see St Mirren down on his Wikipedia page. Enough. But he is now crushing it over in Indonesia at Borneo FC, where he's racked up an impressive 3 appearances. So congratulations to Julian for getting, you know, at least he got 6 months worth of Los Blancos spirit on his seat. In fact, there is a quote from him that says, well, I can always say that I played for Real Madrid. Yeah, twice, Julian. You fell asleep as many times as you started.
He was there for 6 months, now only awake for 2.
Shot to bits.
Okay, now you see me three with Julian Faubert.
100% the worst January signing of all time.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that does take some beating, but I'd like to throw Kostas Mitroglou into the ring. He's always slightly fascinated me, just because he looks so strange.
He looks like a villain, doesn't he? A Disney villain.
He's got this weird goatee and this moustache. He looks like a barber, and he's just a strange-looking guy. But
he looks like he was
a few James Wayne vibes. Yeah. Few James Wayne vibes about that little moustache.
Yeah, I know what you mean, actually. I know what you mean. Him, Sandro Wagner, and James Wayne, yeah. Anyway, he was born in Greece, emigrated to Germany with his parents, and that's where his career started. He joined Borussia Mönchengladbach as an 18-year-old. He left after 1 year, joined Olympiakos, having never played a senior game for Mönchengladbach. And that's where his career sort of kicked off, as it were. He won the League and Cup double in each of his first 2 years, playing a pretty minor role in both of those. And the second of those years, he was actually managed by Ernesto Valverde. Valverde didn't rate Mitroglou one bit, dropped him because he wanted to play a more expansive style.
What?
Valverde, are you sure? I think he's just like Prince Boateng, fuck's sake.
And despite Valverde's success, obviously that League and Cup double twice. He left to go join Villarreal at the end of the year after a financial disagreement. And this is when Mitroglou sort of kicked on at Olympiacos. And he was actually, for a time, a very, you know, he had very good stats in the league. In the Greek league, I should say. So he scored 9 league goals. He got 4 in 12 in Europe. As Olympiacos went through 2 rounds of qualifying and a playoff. And they eventually reached the last 16 of the Champions League, where they lost to Barcelona. So not a bad run there at all. Pretty big achievement for a Greek side, actually. No side has ever got further this century. So they were really, that Olympiacos side were no mugs. But who returns for the 2010-11 season after everything went tits up at Villarreal? It's Ernesto Valverde, back again. Back again for another bye number him, two of the Olympiacos cherry.
But he's back. You can't keep him down. He's like a bad penny.
Yeah. So Mitroglou was pretty pissed off.
Is that a saying? You can't keep a bad penny down?
No, like a bad penny returns always, isn't it? That's the
yeah, I've never heard of that. Bad penny will come find its way back.
Bad penny always finds its way
back. Mitroglou was gutted. Age 22, he was just breaking into the national setup. He, you know, needed a big season. Valverde comes through the door and he's deemed surplus to requirements. He then goes on loan to a side called Panios in Greece. He scores 8 and 11. Then the following year, he's loaned out again to Atromitos. I mean, these are titans of Greek football, guys.
Atromitos, that sounds like a titan, doesn't it?
Unfortunately, not such a good side. But he actually scored 17 league
goals
that
year. Age of Titans. That was a great game. No, Age of Mythology. Sorry, mate. That was a great game.
Never played it. Sounds good, though. Oh, Atromitos and Panios were featuring, I'm sure. And he helped Atromitos finish third behind PAOK. Ahead of PAOK on AEK Athens, which is actually not a bad achievement for them. He then returned to Olympiacos, who are now under Leo Jardim for the 12-13 campaign, scored 20 goals in 42 games in all
under
competitions.
Jardim
was at Olympiacos.
I never knew Mitroglou played under Jardim.
I know. Mental. He had a really good year in the Champions League that year as well. He scored 4 and 8 in the Champions League. He scored 2 versus Arsenal. And he helped Olympiacos finish 15 points clear of PAOK. They also won a league and cup double. So he'd scored, and then the following year, he'd scored 17 and 9 in the first 19 games of the first half of the 13-14 campaign, despite missing a month off with injury, also scored a hat-trick in the Champions League. So at 26, we've got a Champions League proven goal scorer with 38 caps for the Greek national side, 8 goals for the national side as well. He's at the top of his game. He's on the verge of a big money move. It's January 2014. Who enters the race? Fulham. So I need to set the scene a bit with Fulham. So the year before Fulham, before Mitroglou joined Fulham, Fulham finished 12th in the league, and it was Martin Jol's second full season in charge. This continued a sort of downward trend for the club. They'd been 8th, they were then 9th, they were now 12th, and they were massively over reliant on our favourite Bulgarian Dimitar Berbatov. He scored 15 league goals that year and provided 3 assists.
Liquid sex, Berbatov.
Which was his most successful Premier League year, except for that year he won the Golden
Absolute
Boot.
Absolute wet dream.
And he was involved in 36% of their league goals. That summer they brought in Stecklenburg, Scott Parker, Tarapt and Darren Bent on loan.
Sounds like a good spot.
Thought they were moving up in the world.
I mean, other than Adel Tarabt, who was an absolute...
He had his moments.
I mean, yeah, he did. But have you ever seen a player run as hot as Adel Tarabt scoring 350-yarders a game?
Yeah, he also left. He also left after a couple of months. He couldn't face it. Fulham had a disastrous year in 13-14 under Martin Jol. They won just 2... they won 5 of their opening 19 games. scoring 17 and conceding 35. But to give that a bit of context, the first half of this year, Fulham have won 2 of their first 19 games.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And scored 17 and conceded 40. So that just puts into perspective how bad this current Fulham side are. Martin Jol was sacked in early December after they lost 3-0 to West Ham. Rennie Mullenstein came in, the ex-Man United coach.
Shout out.
They rounded off 2013 with a 6-0 loss to Hull City. So they conceded 5 goals in that game after 60 minutes. So here was a team in, you know, desperate need of goals.
Did Magath come in?
Magath comes in.
Oh,
are you going to pick a bond?
I am. So January comes. Berbatov decides he's had enough of this. Don't blame him. He goes to Monaco with Radamel Falcao injured. Mullenstein brings in Ryan Tunnicliffe, John Heitinger and Lewis Holtby on loan from Spurs. Not a bad window. Brian Ruiz had also left, and they managed to fight off competition to sign Mitroglou for £12 million. But it's fair to say it didn't really work out. Fitness issues meant he didn't make his debut until the February the 22nd, by which time Mullenstein had already been fired and replaced by Felix McGath, who was the weirdest man the Premier League has ever seen. He thought you could heal injuries with cheese. Cheese!
So we've had like extensive chats with Steve Sidwell about this on the Football Social, and he was saying that also, and this is going to be in his behind the headlines, when you went to sit down in McGath's office, if you sat down and didn't say anything, he wouldn't say anything. You'd have to say the first word. And they started playing a game like who could hold out the longest before they said something to McGath. And I don't know who it was, but he was saying there was literally, the lads were pissing themselves in the corridor because there was 15 minutes of silence before he went, "What did you want before Gaffer?" And then he started talking normally.
So
really?
Yeah, this is the most bizarre.
You know, as well, McGath, I think he came from Germany, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
And
he was actually quite successful.
There are stories, though, of that previous, when he was in Germany, he would get his players pre-season to run up a mountain and he would not stop until one of them passed out.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, he doesn't sound...
What is that as a fucking technique?
There's also an anecdote where they got back off the coach at 9 o'clock after losing a game. I can't remember where it was, but he made them train after they lost, after they played a game. So that doesn't surprise me that he's
the most hard worker ever.
He doesn't sound like he's got a firm grip on sort of nutrition or biology. He just loves cheese. But he made his debut on February the 22nd. He came on after 60 minutes. They were playing West Brom. They were 1-0 up. He came on for Hugo Rodallega. West Brom came back to 1-1. Apparently, Mitroglou literally made zero effort in that game. I was reading blog posts from that game, and the Fulham fans were like, "Who the hell have we just signed?" He was left out of the next game against Chelsea. He came back for a game against Cardiff. They lost 3-1. He then missed the next 7 games through injury. He came back in early May for their deciding game. They were away at Stoke, managed by Mark Hughes. Mark Hughes being Fulham's former manager, they were desperate to avoid defeat in this game. They lose, they go down. They lost 4-1. Mitroglou came on with 30 minutes to go, and Fulham's relegation after a 14-year stay in the top flight was confirmed. So his Fulham stats look like this in all. He played 151 minutes, 0 goals, 0 assists. He actually averaged 4.2 shots per 90, which is kind of baffling. So it shows that maybe he could have done better with better fitness, but I don't know what was going on there. He cost Fulham £99,000 for every minute he played for them, and he didn't score a goal.
Wow. That is truly
absolutely
abysmal.
Mental. Yeah. And I should
have learned from Steve Marley, shouldn't I?
I feel a little bit sorry for him, to be fair, because it's clearly the Fulham, you know, hierarchy didn't do their background. How do you sign a player for £12 million and they don't play to the end of February because of fitness concerns? Come on. Like, this was Fulham under new ownership in Shahid Khan, whose son has recently said he will die at Fulham. And some of their thinking this time was pretty wayward.
The fans puts a pitchfork through him.
Yeah, absolutely mental. And in fairness, he's gone on to have some success. He went to Olympiacos, won a further title. He scored 52 goals in 86 games for Benfica. And now he's at Marseille, where he scored 16 goals in 49 games. And he regularly comes onto the pitch for a Campos in the last bits of games. So he's had a useful career. Wrong signing, wrong time. But you can't dispute absolute tragedy for Fulham. And Mitroglou's reputation, really.
Greek tragedy.
Mm. Oh, lovely, Chris.
Right, we're back after a short break. Joe going to relieve himself. So, Ken Bates. Not much relief here in this era for Leeds United fans. He comes in, he buys 50% as the front man of an offshore company called Forward Sports Funds. And this is where you're going to have to stick with me because it gets very murky, gentlemen. Okay. Very murky indeed. It's like something from The Big Short. So Forward Sports were managed by a Swiss company, and the authorities, in their own words, found it very hard who was actually responsible for the club. So Bates, hiding in plain sight, ? We'll leave that up to the tax man to decide. But his reign following his acquisition of 50%, still turbulent, very high ticket prices, frequently labelling his detractors dissidents or sick pots, sort of like Donald Trump-esque. You know, this is the fake news of the footballing world.
China.
And in fact, he banned the Guardian and the BBC from the ground because anyone that wanted to do any digging and put together the bigger picture was not welcome.
Seems
at
like
Ellen,
a normal thing to do.
Ellen Road, that yeah. wall.
So in 2007, they were still £35 million in debt, and Leeds, as a result, were placed in voluntary administration by Bates. Now, that summer, something even murkier happens that I did not have the bloody time to research, gentlemen. This is something that Panorama might have to take up. I'm sure someone did at some point, but I didn't find a report on it. So the club apparently owed two more offshore companies money, but they agreed that if Bates/FSF, Forward Sports Fund, were allowed to buy the club, they would wipe the debt.
That's so bizarre. So they were going to do him a favour, according to those reports.
Effectively, yeah, for no clear reason. And I'm not sure if the authorities could identify who owned those offshore companies, because obviously when they're managed by Swiss
companies,
you don't have
to. You don't have to. God, this is an absolute web of deceit.
Exactly.
It's a web of lies involving Leeds United.
It is. So we'll leave that there. But that's kind of to set the scene in terms of how murky this period was, as I said. But as a result, the Football Association told the club they were going to be excluded from the league next year. They were sick of Bates' shit. But in the end, the other clubs allowed them to play with a 15-point deduction. You might remember that.
I do.
Sort of vaguely. Yeah. From this mess, Bates emerges as chairman at a now debt-free club.
Okay, but a 15-point deducted club.
But a 15-point deduction, but one he'd probably take as opposed to paying, I don't know,
the millions
X
that he
amount
owed.
In tax or X amount to these various other offshore companies. Now, they still reached the playoff final despite all these off-the-field issues. They still reached the playoff final in League One, I think this was, but lost to Doncaster 1-0.
That's still crazy, isn't it? 15-point deduction and reached playoff final.
It's pretty impressive. Yeah.
Now, 7 years prior, though, their big games had been against AC Milan and Real Madrid. Now they're losing playoff finals to Doncaster. That's how quickly
Sunderland vibes.
And
I know
deeply
the feeling.
This club have fallen. Yeah, mm-hmm. Doogie. A knowing nod there from Doogie.
I mean,
now,
let's not pretend Sunderland are playing AC Milan.
So,
we went to Wembley, big man.
big man. So let's wrap this up with their promotion from League One. So Sam Grayson built a really talented squad. So some good acquisitions here in winter windows. That included Beckford, Howson, Bradley Johnson, Max Gradle, who went to Bournemouth and had a decent career in France as well.
Toulouse, yeah.
Casper Schmeichel, Fabian Delph, Becchio, Robert Snodgrass. So some really good acquisitions here that were the core of a decent championship side. The club weren't far from controversy in 2011. After developing the East Stand, the mortgaging future season ticket sales, a select committee on culture, media and sport criticised Bates publicly for not disclosing enough about his ownership. This prompted Richard Scudamore, then the Premier League's chief, to say that he needed more information and transparency if Leeds were ever to be allowed to play in the Premier League, if they were promoted.
So this consistently dogged them, not being clear enough about the boardroom activity.
So now, despite some decent acquisitions, slight upturn again. Again, mired in controversy. Bates swiftly announces that he's bought the club outright through another company called Outro. Now, the name is probably a bit of a precursor to his actual his end goal for the club. But in that period, Bates still hires and fires a number of managers, eventually settling on the safe hands of Neil Warnock in February 2012. But 10 months later, Ken Bates, the evil Santa Claus, he's out of there for the sum of £52 million. But that's not where the dodgy owners and sort of shysters stop running amok at Leeds. In 2014, GFH, a Bahrain-based investment bank, took over. No, sorry, they took over in 2012, but by 2014, they were reporting losses of £1 million per month, which made their tenure unsustainable.
£1 million a month?
Yeah.
£12 million a year is outrageous.
Dug out this really nice anecdote by a blogger. I think he's gone on to become a journalist since, called Amitai Winehouse. He started Squareball Fanzine, who claimed that the club were contacting him on a regular basis after reading some of his in-depth posts, asking for sort of advice, but masquerading it as getting him involved at the club. So at the time he was 20, and at one point he was asked who the club should hire, Lambert or Nigel Adkin.
God, that's the dream, isn't it?
My God.
And that's hilarious.
In his own words, he just said that they did not have a clue. And that
imagine
was blatantly
actually reaching out to
obvious.
A blogger to do the work of a director of football, a technical director who's 20 years old. Like, what world
it's
are we living in?
But it gets worse from there. So Chelino comes in. Who was then 57, the owner of Cagliari, so that middling Serie A side from Sardinia. He lodges a bid. Now he's an agricultural trading magnate and convicted fraudster.
Love it.
You know, two big ticks
The Leeds way.
The prerequisites, yeah, for being a Leeds owner. Now, reportedly, he tried to fire then-manager Brian McDermott despite not yet owning the club. Now, this prompted Ross McCormack to phone Sky to protest live on air. Fans converged on the stadium, like barraging GFH and Chelino inside the stadium as they were sort of locked into talks, takeover talks, sorry. Leeds beat Huddersfield 5-1, a managerless Leeds. The next day, McDermott swiftly reinstated just to appease the fans while talks continue. But eventually, Chelino's company, El Nera Sport, agreed to buy 75% of Leeds, only to fail the owners and directors test because at the time, a Sardinian court had just convicted him of tax evasion.
What a lovely bloke.
But in the interim period, there's another player here. So you've got GFH, who are losing £1 million a month. They don't want the club. They haven't got any money. You've got Chelino, who's got money, but he's a convicted fraudster.
And a madman.
Then you've got another player here, David Haig, who I wanted to read up on a little bit more. And this last section might be a little bit piecemeal, so you're going to have to stick with me. But he was chief executive at the time. And while all this was going on, he tried to drum up money for his own takeover bid. Now, Chelino, not one to hide his feelings, subsequently described him as a bitch, a witch, and a fucking devil, all in the same statement. I like
it's good rhyme,
which being my favourite in there. He then described the team as fucking shit in that statement, an official statement. But they went on to be beaten by Bolton 5-1 and Bournemouth 4-1 in the next two fixtures. So it looked like
he wasn't wrong.
He kind of had a point, yeah. It was very complimentary to the fans, though. Started tugging on their heartstrings from very early doors, describing them as feelings. So, Drake, eat your heart out. Soon after this debacle, an independent adjudicator adjudged him fit to own the club. How they made a U-turn on that decision, I don't know. Again, this is just very top-line research on the latter period of Leeds. When he moved into the stadium, drama not over there. So he's seen off Haig's title, his rival bid, sorry. But when he moved into the stadium, he actually ordered a security sweep. You know, people thought he was a little bit paranoid. But they found spy cameras in the boardroom and toilets.
Really?
It's
quite ironic.
North
that.
Yorkshire police, maybe. Haig claimed he had them installed because there was a Class A drug problem on the premises. Not because he was trying to steal corporate secrets, I guess. Okay, but we couldn't possibly comment on that. Again, just observing the top line details. Haig then tried to call in $950,000 from basically, the club owed him some money, or Sports Capital, his firm. They'd loaned him some money, and Chelino refused to pay because, of course, their relationship has deteriorated at this point. The club's bank account was frozen. They finished 15th in that season and couldn't pay the club's wages. This is recent history, gentlemen.
Lovely stuff, yeah.
Although, apparently, this didn't dampen the owner's spirits too much as he sang on stage with the Pigeon Detectives at the end of season awards. So
that'll cheer everyone up.
Let me do a bit of karaoke.
They'll all love it.
Just wanted to get that in there. Haig, subsequently arrested in Dubai, said it was entrapment. He was lured there under false pretenses.
What, by the Pigeon Detectives?
Yeah, not by the Pigeon Detectives, but at this point, you know, a detective, yeah, someone of bloody Serpico standard, definitely needed in the case of Leeds. It's just a drama that continues to.
Who's the owner now?
To spill over. I've actually ended it at Chelino employing David Hockaday because this was about transfers, wasn't it? Not necessarily Bielsa and their sort of surge to the Premier League this season. But even that's been mining controversy. It's crazy, right, man. They're the gift that keeps on giving. It is like reality TV. Yeah, anyway, back to Haig, who spent time between 2012 and 14 in Bur Dubai police station with GFH, so the guys that Chilino took over from, claiming he embezzled $6 million.
And what's going on?
Haig came back, gave reports in England that said he was tortured at this point. And again, they lured him out there and kept him under false pretenses.
What is happening?
It's you can see why I was really struggling to wrap my head around this. I was doing preparation until the very final minutes of this podcast. But June 2014, Chilino employs David Hockaday, who only had experience at Forest Green Rovers in the non-league beforehand.
Shout out Forest Green.
Pretty much bookending a series of unfortunate events.
I mean, that was chaos.
I mean,
it was pure chaos.
Since then, it really just highlighted the job Bielsa is doing now. One new addition, although he's just signed Casillas, and he's from Real Madrid, the goalkeeper. I think it was just the youngster from Manchester City. He'd played at New York City.
Jack Harrison.
The winger, Jack Harrison. He's taken a team that lost 20 league games to the summit of the Championship. I think they're 5 points clear. But Spygate happened. And that's sort of the lowdown on Leeds and why transfers cannot be separated with their tumultuous time as a football club. But I'm blue in the face, gentlemen.
Yes.
I think we should move on to Rose Ed very quickly.
Let's do
and
it.
Then I'm doing facts, aren't I, with Rafa Benitez. We hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. Get your suggestions for future podcasts on our, well, Twitters, Instagrams,
yes.
In the YouTube comments. Hit us up, yeah? Thanks. Right, so every week before we've run the podcast, we've got a tweet out in terms of what you want to kick out of football in our Row Z section. And we had a plethora of suggestions this week.
Cheers, guys.
First one coming from Brad with a world emoji in his name. A man of the world, this Brad. And he's put, people who say Virgil van Dijk is the best centre-back of Premier League history. The floor is yours, boys.
Yeah, I think this is really silly. I mean, he's only been at Liverpool, what, a year? He's only played for a top side in the Premier League for a year. He was obviously very good at Southampton. But it is far too early. You can't discount everything that Ferdinand did. Terry, Carragher, you know, Tony Adams. You know, absolute legends of the game over a player that hasn't even won a trophy yet, I'm
Pallister,
afraid.
Pallister, Bruce.
Yeah, it goes on and on.
So, he's not even in the top, like, 10, top 5.
What? You don't think he's better than Pallister or Bruce?
No.
He's a modern centre-back.
Yeah, I also saw Liverpool fans the weekend saying, genuinely, this was a post, is Virgil van Dijk better than Maldini? What world are we living in when comparisons like that are taking the floor? Seriously, at 27, Maldini had won 3 Champions Leagues, 4 Scudetti. What world are we living in? Van Dijk's been there 18. He's had a good 18
very
months.
Short memories.
Good 18 months, Van Dijk's had. And he is the best centre-back in the Premier League right now. But have a day off comparing him to Maldini, for fuck's sake. He'd won 2 times World Cup Player of the Year.
I think talent-wise...
Talent-wise,
he could be in the discussion. But you can't say he's the best in the Premier League history because that requires you to win something. That requires you to be part of a winning side. And he hasn't done that yet. So, you know... Come back in 5 years' time, and he might well be. But.
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. Ability wise, he's up there, but you have to have won.
Yeah, give him some bloody time. He's only been there 18 months.
Full of trophies.
18 months he's been there. Like you say, come back when he's 32, and we'll talk. Or, he's 27 at the moment.
I mean, or when he's 39, like Maldini. Let's see if he's still playing.
No.
Right, next one is from Kieran Grant. 7 likes. Big up yourself. Constant comparisons of one player to another, and labelling youngsters the next. Big thing, ..
Yeah, this is arguably one of the worst things in football, but you just can't get rid of it. I'm afraid you cannot kick comparisons out of the game. Otherwise, you have very little debate. I think comparisons are arguably the spine of most footballing debate.
Do you think he's saying more so setting up youngsters to fail by giving them unrealistic expectations?
Messi,
so bloody, I mean, it was the next Maradona, wasn't it?
Of course,
it was Pablo Aymar, was Javier Saviola.
Again, you just got to not listen to morons. Like, pick and choose who you listen to. Some fuckwits
will
compare. But
you listen to this podcast.
Yeah, some fuckwits will compare people. Like, oh, this is the next Lionel Messi. No, it's just not, is it? You know, he's not replicatable.
Yeah, they can be useful, though, comparisons. I mean, you're actually listening to the comparison king at the moment. I love a comparison. A combined 11s. I think it's quite an interesting way
the
of
the combined 11 thing. It's is an
interesting
great.
Interesting it's way so of pure. Seeing who's got a better side, I think. And I do enjoy comparisons, but yeah, I can see why it rubs people up the wrong way at times.
But there's
well.
Nothing wrong with more meaningful comparisons. So what we've always tried to do is base it in some sort of statistical analysis.
Rather
so
than just feeling.
I fucking love comparing, you know, when we're looking for players for the podcast and you're getting the radars up on Understat and they lay them over one another and you're like, oh my God, he's so much better than him in that fucking area of the game, and it's so clear and I can say that so concisely. So, you know, it really gets me going. But yeah, I agree, kind of not giving youngsters the breathing room to develop into their own players, become their own men. You know, like Joe Cole, we've got him coming on a transfer deadline show next week, and a lot of people said, oh, he never filled his potential, but he won 3 Premier Leagues.
Yeah.
By the time he was 30, I think he'd started over 15, 20 games in 12, 13 different Premier League seasons. Like, the guy was physically spent by 30, admittedly, and you know, Liverpool wasn't a great period, and
Neither was West Ham.
I mean, banged at Tampa Bay Bowdies? Rowdies.
Rowdies.
Right, next Tampa. One. Kevin De Bruyne.
West Ham the second time, to clarify on that.
Yeah, West Ham. He did go back, didn't he, second time? He actually played well then, didn't he, that season? Got 5 goals, I think. Teams charging hundreds for kids to be mascots before the game.
Yeah, it's a bit sick, isn't it? You know, it's supposedly the happiest day of their lives so far. Why are you charging small children and their families to, you know, fall in love with the game? It's like a tax on enjoyment and a tax on, you know, potential love of the game. I don't like it at all.
Yeah, I agree. It's just a bit wrong, isn't it? But certain teams have to do it. Tottenham need new
stadium. What do you mean have to do
Tottenham
it?
Need new stadium. They got fuck all money. They ain't got no players coming through the door.
I think, how can you be giving someone thousands of pounds a week and then charge fucking £500?
I'm only joking. Yeah, Can't do it, of course.
Yeah, to fuck about in a bear outfit. I don't...
No. I think it's to hold the player's hand.
It's not the mascot. It's not the bear. Gunnosaurus isn't doing it for free, boy. Fuck me. His life's a mess if he is.
Gunnosaurus. imagine sticking a kid in a Gunnosaurus outfit. Go on, then.
Go on, then.
They're holding the hands and coming on the pitch, isn't it? The McDonald's kid.
It's a boiler, mate. It's a boiler.
Oh, yeah, it's a boiler at West Brom. Yeah, not a freezer.
A boiler. They've got their mascot's a boiler now.
It's just a man in a boiler. Not a boiler suit, a boiler.
A boiler.
Yeah, like
an inflatable boiler.
Yeah, they're sponsored by like...
Yeah, some gas company.
He gets so much abuse at the sides of the games.
Shit house.
I love it when the mascots fight.
Yeah.
That's quality. So Archie Munro with the next one. Pundits who think Kante could play in Jorginho's role. And you had a lot to say about this on Winners and Losers, didn't you, John?
He couldn't play in that role, but he could play in that position. I don't think that Sarri is playing the correct roles at Chelsea, so I think that Kante right now would be a better defensive midfield option than Jorginho. I love Jorginho, and he is probably the best registrar in world football, but...
Registrar.
I don't know why I said registrar. Why did I say that?
I was thinking, I'm just going to...
Registrar, why the fuck did I say
he
that?
He takes the subs at training.
Yeah.
He's great admin.
Regista, he's probably the best regista in world football. Why did that come out of my mouth then? I wasn't concentrating.
It's all right, mate. I said fucking...
But equally, I don't know, man. I think Kante's a better defensive midfielder than Jorginho. Just do.
Yeah. So you don't think that he should replace Jorginho, but you think Kante shouldn't be...
I don't think... This is my point.
Forced out of his position.
I don't think Jorginho is good enough to sacrifice Kante. If Jorginho was that good, I would say, okay, put Kante on the bench. I don't think sacrificing Kante in his best role, that also, by the way, does come to some level at the sacrification... Is that the word? Of Eden Hazard as well playing in his best role. It's a knock-on effect. I don't think Jorginho's worth it. And maybe Sarri disagrees, and he clearly does because he loves him, doesn't he? But I don't think it's worth it.
He's not going to use Jorginho, who he bought for £50 million, he's not going to put him on the bench, though.
Then you got a bench canter.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he should. He's not going to do it, but he should probably change formation. But he's been so wedded to 4-3-3 for so long. I don't think necessarily works with those players. Kante is doing an able job of it, but you actually don't. I don't know whether you want Kante at the base of your midfield either. Like, he always works better, in my opinion, when he's attached to someone who's a better passer.
It would absolutely not
Pogba
surprise
in the World
me.
Cup, or even Drinkwater when he was at Leicester, or Matic when in his first year at Chelsea. I think that's when Kante's been at his best. And I don't think you want Kante having 90 passes per game.
It would absolutely not surprise me to see Kante leave this summer for PSG.
Really?
If they don't manage to put off the bid for Alan, I think
put in a bid for Idrissa as well, haven't they?
Yeah, I would not surprise me at all to see him go.
Okay, last one comes from And Annie, and he's put kicking out fake outrage. What Bielsa did was prime shithousery, and I respect that. With all the different tapping up stories and people getting away with all kinds of FFP things in football, should we be focusing on this?
Yes. Anything else to add?
Any more?
not really. I mean, I enjoyed the shithousery and there's clearly bigger issues.
So you agree that kicking it out? Fake outcry. We can move on to
I don't think it was fake outcry. I think it is really bad what he did.
Huh?
I think it is bad.
Why?
Because I don't think it's not morally right. He's gone and effectively stole other people's tactics. Why didn't he do it through video technology, through watching people's games?
But he's doing it through that as well.
Well, just do it through that. Why are you sending people to the training?
It's not illegal.
Well, if you're trespassing, it is.
It is. He wasn't actually trespassing. He was caught with pliers.
It's a bit weird as well.
It is a bit weird, but equally, he is pushing the limits to what we believe possible for analysis. And to do that, he has to break and bend.
I think he'd have been fine watching. What did he say? What, he watched 51 Derby games in the build-up to that game. Why does he need to go send a guy in the bushes?
Because he discovered from that Harry Wilson wasn't going to be playing that game.
It does change it if they are breaking and entering. I've got to.
What was he planning with those guys?
I'm like, if that gives him, if I'm all for it, if he can get the edge from public property.
So Celtic are playing Barcelona in a big last 16 clash. I don't know what year we're in now, but in the future,
I'll have you know we beat them in the UEFA Cup.
This is true, and Barcelona scouts they're all in the bushes around your training ground. You're fine with that.
As long as it's legal on public property and they're overlooking you, what's wrong with it?
Yeah, which it wouldn't happen at Celtic's ground. But that's by the by. I get what you're saying.
The top teams wouldn't.
As a guy who supports a club who would have to, in order to beat these bigger sides, find those marginal gains. If my club were doing it, I wouldn't champion it, but I'd understand it, I wouldn't have a massive problem.
Bielsa was the manager of Sunderland, would you be loving it?
No, I don't think I would.
Bullshit.
I don't think I would. And if it got... But the question is, if it gets done to you?
The thin grey line...
You wouldn't be pleased if you came up against Leeds in the cup,
yeah,
Joe.
The thin grey line...
They were spying on Man United.
Is them breaking into the property with pliers. That's where you draw a line in the sand. But if they've got like a... You'd be naive to think this doesn't happen absolutely everywhere. And... Listen, it's all is fair in love and war. Yeah,
Andre VS Boas did it every game for Jose Mourinho.
In the bushes, was he?
Probably. Either that or in the toilets.
He was actually hidden a
laundry
not
VS
Boas, but yeah.
Laundry basket vibes.
Anyway, thank you for your row at Zeds again. Get them in to us next week. Keep your peepers peeled for that tweet on your timelines. Moving on to facts.
It's a fact. Facts. Facts.
Here it is then, gentlemen. It's taken me a little while to work out what was the truth and what was a lie. Head is gone.
We haven't even started.
But this week's theme is money, and you are looking for one lie in
classic camel
three
fashion.
Statements. I've reversed the usual theme. It's now just in my head. It's ingrained in my head. That is the way we do it.
You've tried to push that agenda for the last 2 weeks, and now you've just coined it yourself.
I'm just doing it, regardless.
So we're hunting for a lie here, dude.
Okay. Right, okay. So, statement number one. I once skipped a day of school to pick up a faulty shipment of kettles and juices, which I sold to my friends who gifted them to their mothers for Mother's Day. Statement two. Me and my friends that started a clothes brand paid former X Factor contestant Jake Quickenden to interview Pixie Lott in one of our T-shirts. Statement three, I used to sell satellite dishes at university that enabled pubs to get Sky Italia for a good price.
Wow. Quite a wheeler dealer you are.
Now, I know he definitely used to distribute satellite dishes at university. Whether or not...
It was Sky Italia.
It was Sky Italia remains to be seen. Why did
Where
they
did
have
you get your dishes from?
Why do they have Sky Italia?
Because... The European Court of Justice hadn't laid down any law at that time about the distribution of like foreign services on English soil. So there's a grey area that enabled a firm that I became privy to sell these satellite dishes in the UK for a very small window.
Was it?
Have time.
Was it all above board? It all sounds a bit...
It wasn't legal, but it wasn't illegal.
Okay.
There was no legislation on it at that time.
I think that might be true because he came out pretty swiftly with the European Court of Justice, which isn't an easy thing to rustle up.
If you were trying to think of a European Court, you would just go, yeah, a European Court of Justice. The only one I know.
Human rights? The European Court of Human Rights?
Yeah, but this is not to do with human rights, is it? Is this to do with justice?
Yeah, justice for the satellites. justice for Sky Italia. I think that's the truth.
Now RoboCop's turned up.
Yeah. And then you were selling faulty kettles to people's mums?
So yeah, I took the day off of school in year 11 to go to a Philips factory that my dad's friend Twisty worked at.
What's Twisty short for?
I don't know his full name.
Okay.
Just knew him as Twisty. Right. We had a strictly business relationship. Okay. But there were several.
Dad was the kettle dealer.
All my dad's friends had nicknames at this pub. There was Rocket Ron. There was...
He sounds believable, Rocket Ron.
Rocket Ron was the caretaker at school. But several others that I, you know, we'll move on. What were you asking?
About the kettles.
So I went to the Philips factory that Twisty owned. Loads of these kettles, juicers, hair straighteners either had small faults, like aesthetic damage, mm-hmm. or the boxes were damaged, or they didn't come with instructions. So they're all perfectly good, but couldn't be sold at retail.
So you weren't going to burn women?
So, no. So not responsible for anything exploding. I hope not, touch wood. But basically, my dad was like, Chris, quick way to earn a buck here. You're going on a lad's holiday soon. You can pay for your holiday, you know, if you flip a few kettles. And I used to love the flip. Would go to car boots, you know, regularly, pick up Nintendo 64s, sell them on eBay or Dreamcast, tidy little profit. Always a lot of money to be out in vintage gaming, Duke.
But your mates, all of them, wanted to buy faulty kettles for their mum.
If I'd have bought kettles and
my mum would be gutted.
Toasters, my mates would have gone, what the fuck are you doing with that?
They were lovely kettles.
Really?
And Glenn Waters, shout out Glenn, one of my close mates at the time. I sold him a kettle for £1. So discounted rates for the inner circle, I'll have you know.
What do you mean £1? How are you making profit for this lad's holiday?
I had so much stuff. I had a boot full of stuff that at the end of it, I think it probably raised £400 or £500. Juices fetch a fair bit on eBay. That I was just letting this shit go for pennies on the dollar, mate.
I'm intrigued about that one.
Yeah, a lot of them gave their... It was Mother's Day around that period, so I just remember a lot of them giving their stuff.
And what was number three?
Yeah, what was number two?
So we started a brand. It was originally called Kippers. And then we were like, because Kipper is like, my old Kipper is like slang for mate, isn't it? And then we were like, we need to think of something.
Kippers? Yeah. I only know Kippers as a fish.
I've never heard of my old Kipper.
Yeah,
but
it might just be colloquialism. Yeah. But it was like, we need to think of something more stupid that people are going to remember. So it got elongated to Kippers and Slippers, which not a lot of people forgot about. But it ultimately very, very unsuccessful. At the time, sort of very kind of social media was a little bit rawer, and some way, shape, or form, we got hold of Jake Quickenden, and he had just been an X Factor the year before, and he was doing a little bit of presenting, and he actually interviewed Pixie Lott in a purple T-shirt that had one of the fish sitting on an anchor in the bottom left. You can't check out the Instagram. It sat on the bottom left, and that is the closest that, you know, something I have touched has been to Pixie Lott. So
okay,
and we paid him.
He's definitely 100% had a clothing company with his mates called Kippers and Slippers. Really? I know that for a fact.
We paid him a very nominal fee as well, gentlemen, of £175.
I just don't know this. Jake Quickenden, is he the sort of guy that would wear a Kippers and Slippers
T-shirt? I think he's exactly the sort of guy that would wear a Kippers and Slippers T-shirt.
No offense to Kippers
and
Slippers.
Don't you fucking go on the Instagram, George.
Surely you'd want to look quite good in front of Pixie Lott on Kippers.
What do you mean?
Kippers and Slippers with a little fish and an anchor in the bottom left.
I'll have
sounds
you know,
a bit weird.
We were in 5 shops.
Really?
One in Manchester, one in Nottingham, 2 in Leicester. Forget what the other one was.
I feel like Kippers and Slippers one is real.
Do you?
I feel like Quickenden is real. At the moment, I'm edging towards... What was the third one again?
Kettles. Think the satellite dishes.
I think it was satellite dishes. I don't think it was Sky Italia. I think it might have just been you get a sports channel for free, or he was distributing to his friends.
Sky Italia died out over here in like the
90s. Very, very long time ago.
Because there used to be that programme, I think, where they purely cover Italian football. Anyway, I digress. I'm not really convinced. I think Kippers and Slippers sounds strange.
That's 100% real. I know for a fact Kippers and Slippers is a real brand.
And then the faulty kettles to people's mums at Mother's Day to try and earn a holiday.
The issue with Kippers and Slippers is the Quickenden area. He's definitely got a clothing brand and it was in a few shops and he tried his best to get it launched. But whether it was Quickenden, it could easily have been another X Factor contestant or another
or
Zed
not Pixie Lott.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything about the faulty kettles?
I also know that he did used to sell things out the back of his back, particularly electronics out the back of his.
You're wasted
car.
In football, Chris. You should have just become a salesman.
It could be that it wasn't Quickenden, but Quickenden's just such a perfect profile, and it's such an odd name just to pull.
So you're thinking kettles might not be true.
I'm not. I think Sky Italia is fake.
Oh, you're sticking me that. And we have to agree. I'm kind of with you, actually, because I think Sky Italia would have been... Chris went to uni, must have been right in 2010, I would have thought. So, I'm not thinking about Sky Italia.
Sky Italia, Hammer, was the lie.
That's the lie.
Okay, so... I did once ship a load of electronic goods at the back of a car, taking a day off school.
Kettles are us.
I did sell satellites to pubs around Nottingham.
Was it?
We didn't pay Quickenden. He did it for free.
That's your minor detail. What? That is pathetic. Facts.
Oh.
Rafa Benitez it'd be out here with sheets. Yeah. Pointing at numbers and areas that he's not happy with.
Who knows? Maybe the next time I do it will be two truths.
Yeah,
the proper system.
Fuming.
So that's it. That's this podcast.
No, it's not two truths. It's one truth. You even got it wrong then, you thick bastard.
I will never get that right, okay? And that's the end of the podcast. See you later, guys. Thank you for downloading.
Cheers,
thanks for sticking with us till the end. We're actually not here next week. We're going to take a week break on the podcast. Got 3 live shows next week, so very, very busy. But we need your ideas for topics. Have launched a Reddit page where you can submit them. So,
do it. Bye.
Bye.